Hi, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Monday, July 22nd, 1996. In the fireside room this evening, our speaker is Larry Rasmussen. Today he'll be beginning his series on Jubilee and the Sustainable Society. Today's session number is 6 and is titled Sweet Betsy and Her Avalanche, How the Planet Got Unsustainable. Let's listen in.
My name is Larry Rasmussen, and this is a series this week around the theme of Jubilee and the Sustainable Society. And this particular session is entitled Sweet Betsy and Her Avalanche, How the Planet Got Unsustainable. As we will learn as the week goes along, the touchstone here is Leviticus 25 as a reference point, and it is in fact a vision of a sustainable society. It is a vision of a socially sustainable society, an economically sustainable society on land that both sustains the people and is itself sustained. So that is a biblical vision from in instructions given in the Torah itself. And we're going to use it as a base point to jump a few millennia and talk about the issue of the fact that we live on a planet which is economically, socially, and environmentally unsustainable. The Brundtland Commission report, which was a commission headed up by Gro Brundtland, the Prime Minister of Norway, for the Earth Summit in Rio de Janeiro in 1992, said that if a majority of people in the world would live, namely 4 billion, were to live the way the richest 1 billion live, which includes all middle-class people as well as all rich people, it would take 7 to 10 planets like the one we've got to sustain that level of consumption. Read unsustainability. Or if you put it in the words of Thomas Berry, Earth is a one-time endowment, and we're now drawing down the endowment in a way in which it's at a rate faster than it's being replenished. And of course, part of it, as our Vespers tonight communicated, is an endowment that can't be replaced. Or if you use the terms of E.F. Schumacher, we're now living off the capital and not just off the interest. And all of these read unsustainability as a condition. Now we can talk more about what unsustainability means in the discussion. I just want to use the initial point of reference in the Jubilee as a way of then being able to think about how we get from unsustainability to sustainability. Briefly, and very, very briefly, in the instructions in Leviticus 25, you are to let the land lie fallow for a year, every seventh year. Actually, everybody gets a sabbatical. People get a sabbatical, the land gets a sabbatical, and beasts of burden get a sabbatical. For some reason, this only caught on in academe. It's unfortunate. If a sabbatical had caught on everywhere else, we'd be a whole lot better off. And then 7 years times 7 years, after that sequence, or that whatever that is, of seven times seven, the 50th year is to be a Jubilee year. And in that year, too, everybody gets a sabbatical, the animals, the land, the people. In that Jubilee year, you also forgive debts. I'm using Maria Harris's brief summary here, letting forgiveness in. Debts are forgiven on all sides. There's some speculation as to whether the petition of the Lord's Prayer, forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors, is not an intimation of Jubilee, because the Greek word for debts there is literally debts. We say sins, we say trespasses, and that may be appropriate, but the word is also literally debts. So the forgiveness of debts on all sides is a Jubilee instruction. You shall free captives and proclaim liberty. So in every 50 years, those who have been taken into slavery or indentured servanthood are to go free. You find out what belongs to whom and give it back. There's a return of the lands to the ancestral owners every 50 years. And you just have a great big feast. Cherry's Jubilee is what we're going to do this week for Jubilee. Let me mention three books, two of whom I have in hand. The bookstore has multiple copies of Maria Harris's Proclaim Jubilee, subtitled Spirituality for the 21st Century. She takes the notion of Jubilee and says what she thinks it means now, as we on the cusp of a new millennium search for a way to get from unsustainability to sustainability. And I strongly commend this to you. It's a short book, 110 pages. Questions at the end of each chapter make it a good one to work with in a group. She's an engaging writer, just for a general audience, a good piece. If you want to look at the biblical roots and discussions of Jubilee, rather than Maria Harris's sort of taking those and asking what they mean for us, I want to work through those biblical intimations of Jubilee and grounding of the notion of Jubilee. This book is also in the bookstore. Sharon Ringey, a New Testament professor in Washington, D.C., Jesus, Liberation, and the Biblical Jubilee, Images for Ethics and Christology. Many of you know that the kind of messianic platform in Luke 4, 16 to 20, proclaiming liberty to the captives, sight to the blind, announcing the year of the Lord's favor, that Jesus announces the synagogue in Nazareth, is often considered a Jubilee announcement, understanding his own mission in Jubilee terms. Well, if you want to pursue that, this is a good one. And the book that isn't in there, that is written out of this very notion, that has meant a lot to a lot of people in this place and many others, is John Howard Yoder's The Politics of Jesus, which uses that Luke messianic platform as its basis. Okay, so those are some resources. We have a few intimations of Jubilee in the United States, in Pennsylvania, to be precise. If you look on the Liberty Bell, you will see the phrase, "Ye shall proclaim liberty throughout the land to all its inhabitants." That's what's on the Liberty Bell. That's from Leviticus 25. It wasn't liberty to all its inhabitants. It wasn't liberty to African American slaves. It wasn't liberty to the native peoples of this country. But if you look really closely in Leviticus 25, you'll see that the slaves, if they are Hebrew slaves, get to go free. The slaves, if they are foreign slaves, don't get to go free. So there's a little hedging on Jubilee all the way around here. From the very beginning, we're recognizing folks a lot like us. Still staying in Pennsylvania, William Penn's vision for the Quakers and for the Pennsylvania colony was in fact one informed by the Jubilee vision. In Penn's book, The Fruits of Solitude, he writes, "We have nothing we can call our own, No, not ourselves, for we are all but tenants, and at the will of the great Lord of ourselves and the rest of the great farm, the world we live upon. The picture of Jubilee in Leviticus 25, as throughout the whole of the Hebrew Bible, only Yahweh, only God, owns the land. Everybody else is a tenant farmer. And that's how William Penn saw the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania as well. The world's a great farm in which we're all tenant farmers. Earth itself is a commonwealth, whether it's the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania or the Commonwealth of Virginia or the whole planet. We are to till and to tend, but we are to never own. And in fact, its stewards in the Bible are precisely the folks who don't own the land, but are expected to take care of it. There isn't ownership. So if you are a steward, that's a part of it. It's Yahweh who alone owns the land. Stewards are to till and keep and enjoy it. All right, with that as just a very brief introduction to the biblical notion of Jubilee as a vision of sustainable society, socially, economically, ecologically, I want to jump a few millennia to ask how we arrived now at unsustainability as our condition. My thesis is this, and because it's a thesis, it's arguable, so there's some time to do that. But the thesis is that the present globalizing economy is unsustainable. And not only economically, it's unsustainable ecologically and socially. What I'll do to get to our time to argue the thesis is offer a little history in support of it. And I've put some dates up on the board. We mustn't forget to get to Sweet Betsy. Are you still holding the pitch? Okay. The New York Times book review ran a piece which was entitled Developing Ourselves to Death. It was a review of a book by Bruce Rich entitled Mortgaging the Earth, the World Bank, Environmental Impoverishment, and the Crisis of Development. I'm not going to pursue Rich's argument. I'm just going to quote you the opening line of the review. Economic development may seem so much a part of modern times as to render self-evident Bruce Rich's premise that it is now the organizing principle for every society and nation on the planet. End of quotation. Yet Rich notes that it is a relatively new idea in history, economic development. Spreading out from Western Europe in the 17th century to conquer the world over the next three centuries. And then the reviewer says, these are the same three centuries in which people have most extensively altered the global environment. So the time of economic development catching on as what all modern societies ought to be doing, those centuries, 17 to 20, are the same time frame in which the global environment has been most altered. That's the common notation here. Now, let me just cite three citations from four famous authors in three famous books laid side by side. And I put the dates and the authors up there and see what you see coming together here. The first is from Adam Smith in The Wealth of Nations, written in that precocious year of 1776. Smith said this with some apparent confidence, quote, the discovery of America and that of a passage to the East Indies by the Cape of Good Hope are the two greatest and most important events recorded in the history of humankind. The discovery of America and finding a way around Africa. Little more than a half century later, Charles Darwin, in the book The Voyage of the Beagle, 1839, said this: "Wherever the European had trod, death seems to pursue the aboriginal. We may look to the wide extent of the Americas, Polynesia, the Cape of Good Hope, and Australia, and we find the same result." End of quote. And only 9 years after Darwin, in 1848, Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels included the following in the little book, Manifesto of the Communist Party: "The discovery of America and the rounding of the Cape of Good Hope opened up fresh ground for the rising bourgeoisie. The East Indian and Chinese markets, the colonization of America, trade with the colonies, the increase in the means of exchange and in commodities generally, gave to commerce, to navigation, to industry, an impulse never given before, and thereby to the revolutionary element in the tottering feudal society gave a rapid development." Now, isn't it intriguing that a moral philosopher, and remember Adam Smith was not an economist, he was a moral philosopher describing the new economy, tracking early capitalist economics, a biologist describing natural selection and developing evolution as a theory, and social historians and critics of rising industrial capitalism, none of whom is reading the other, should all mention the discovery of America and the rounding of the Cape of Good Hope as epoch-making events. Even more intriguing are the possible connections, historically, of the most important events recorded in the history of mankind, that's Smith, to the revolutionary change and development of European society, from feudal society to capitalism, that's Marx and Engels, and both of these to the death of aboriginal peoples and cultures, that's Darwin. And none of this is recorded in 1992, looking back 500 years of conquest and colonization, commerce, Christianity, and civilization. This is all recorded independently of one another within three quarters of a century, beginning in 1776. These three citations are three of four from the book of an environmental historian. His name is Albert Crosby, and I put the title up here, Ecological Imperialism, The Biological Expansion of Europe, 900 to 1900. Did you get the subtitle? The Biological Expansion of Europe, Ecological Imperialism. Now, Crosby doesn't think Europeans are any more imperialistic than any other people. They're not genetically different. They're as interested in giving the neighbors a tough time as any other people, and not more aggressive. But something happened in this period, 900 to 1900, that altered forever the globe, environmentally, ecologically, and as we will see in other ways. And I'm going to just quote a start where Crosby does on page one. The book opens this way: "European immigrants and their descendants are all over the place, which requires explanation. It is more difficult to account for the distribution of this subdivision of the human species than that of any other. The locations of the others make an obvious kind of sense. All but a relatively few of the members of the many varieties of Asians live in Asia. Black Africans live on three continents, but most of them are concentrated in their original latitudes, the tropics, facing each other across one large ocean." They didn't go across that one voluntarily. "Amerindians, with few exceptions, live in the Americas. And nearly every last Australian Aborigine dwells in Australia. Eskimos live in the circumpolar lands, and Melanesians, Polynesians, and Micronesians are scattered throughout the islands of only one ocean, albeit a large one. All these peoples have expanded geographically, have committed acts of imperialism, if you will. But they have expanded into lands adjacent to, or at least near to, those in which they had already been living. Or in the case of the Pacific peoples, to the next island and then to the next after that, however many kilometers of water might be between. Europeans, in contrast, seem to have leapfrogged around the world. Then Crosby goes on to use an image taken from beekeeping, and he says, Europeans have swarmed again and again and have selected new homes as if each swarm were physically repulsed by the others. Now, Europeans have swarmed in two senses. Both of them are important to the biological expansion of Europe and to ecological imperialism. Europeans first swarmed as population. The highest population growth rates in recorded histories are not those of Asians, Africans, and Latin Americans. By far, the highest growth rates, population growth rates in history, are those of Europeans between the years 1750 and 1930. And if any of you have been to Ellis Island, you know that all of those folks that came through Ellis Island were Europeans. Now remember, 1750 to 1930, this is the majority of the time of those three centuries that Stevens noted and that Smith, Marx, and Darwin noted. The number of Caucasians in this period of 1750 to 1930, number of Caucasians increased five times as compared with a 2.3 increase for Asians and slightly less than two for Africans. Those are the numbers I put up there. In what Crosby calls, and that includes African Americans, 2%. In what Crosby calls the Neo-Europes, that's the places the Europeans leapfrogged to. The Americas, Australia, New Zealand, the tip of Africa. In the Neo-Europes, the population between 1750 and 1930 increased phenomenally. It increased more than 14 times, whereas the jump for the rest of the world was 2.5 times, so seven times as much. In the more recent slice of this period, just from 1840 to 1930, lots of you are sitting here, you're in this Neo-Europe, and can know the generations from that period, 1840 to 1930. In that recent slice, the European population at home grew from 194 million to 463 million. That was still double the rate of increase of the population of the rest of the world in that same period, as recent as 1840 to 1930. Okay, so the highest population growth in the world's history is the European population in this period. During the same century, 1840 to 1930, the second swarming of Europeans occurred. Not population growth this time, but immigration. The deluge occurred between 1820 and 1930. And if you think of your family history, it probably falls in terms of immigration in the period from 1820 to 1930. Mine does. Over 50 million Europeans migrated to establish or solidify the Neo-Europes abroad. Recorded immigration has never happened on a scale like that before or since. 50 million people in a century. 50 million people was in fact one-fifth of the entire population of Europe One out of every five European left. The numbers would be far different, but just imagine if one out of every five Chinese left now. This is just staggering. Now what's happening here, and what counts as the significance of these swarmings? Certainly the conquest of new worlds is happening, and the establishment of Western sources for what today is misleadingly termed globalization. Moreover, this state of affairs seems utterly taken for granted by Caucasians, even as it turns transnational and multicultural. That is to say, I'm quoting or citing Crosby now, he offers the aside that the 30 million square kilometers secured by whites around the globe is one of the greatest aberrations in the demographic history of the planet. Taking 30 million square kilometers of land never happened before this, hasn't happened since. But, aberrant or not, Crosby says, evidently this is a situation this minority considers permanent. There aren't any indications that we're going to be giving the Americas back, or Australia or New Zealand or Southern South Africa. Considered permanent as well, to recall Bruce Rich, is a self-evident organizing principle for every society and nation this side of this dual swarming, namely economic development, is firmly entrenched. And that's what the policies now are international, whether it's the policy of corporations or whether it's the policies of the big international institutions like the World Bank and the IMF, or for that matter, most of the United Nations. But, and this is my point, and I want us to have time to discuss. The point is that to read this 500 years since Columbus in the manner of raw political and economic exploitation only, as led by demographics, prevents us from seeing something even more significant. And that's the fact that culture and environment are impacted together. History and nature are impacted by this dual swarming in a way that has altered the planet. First of all, understand how strange the New World was to these Europeans, and also how confident that they were about their mission of commerce, Christianity, and civilization. I can just give you an example from my neighborhood that'll probably help you on this. If you walk up from on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, so that go to the Hudson River and look across to the Palisades of New Jersey, you will see the Palisades as the cliffs that drop almost straight away into the Hudson River Valley. Those rock are rock from the time of the pulling apart of the continents. The continents, you know, were all together in what we sometimes call Pangaea, and then floated on their tectonic plates to the place where we have them today. And there's still movement going on. So the rest of New Jersey is not Long Island. The rest of New Jersey is on the other side of the Atlantic. That's why if you look at the map, you'll see how Europe and the Mediterranean and Africa fit sort of nicely into the Gulf of Mexico and Brazil, etc. What happened because of the pulling apart of Pangaea is that even at the same latitudes and longitude, plants and animals, life, evolved differently. All right? Who was it that stitched together Pangaea? The discovery of the Americas and the rounding of the Cape of Good Hope. It was European sailors, once they learned the ocean currents sufficiently well to cross the ocean, the big oceans, Pacific and the Atlantic, stitched together these different zones that had evolved differently in terms of their flora and fauna, and in many ways their peoples, although that's very recent, as we heard in Vespers this evening, development of peoples. Okay, so once the European sailors did this, and then you started getting Europeans on those boats to settle, they found lands that were very strange to them, even though the climate was similar. So you have Mr. Martin from Great Britain complaining as he visited Australia in the 1830s. The trees retained their leaves and shed their bark instead. The swans were black, the eagles white, the bees were stingless, some mammals had pockets, others laid eggs. It was warmest on the hills and coolest in the valleys, and even the blackberries were red. It's a strange world out there, folks. But, noted from another angle, the very regions that today produce the majority of the foodstuffs of European origin and provenance, grains and meats, those regions that now produce the majority of grains and meats had no wheat, no barley, no rye, no cattle, no pigs, no sheep, no goats whatsoever 500 years ago. Biologically, this was the expansion of Europe. Ecologically, this was the expansion of Europe. What has happened as well is that the particular grain and meat based systems that have now become the majority systems for food production of the world have marginalized or exterminated almost all other forms of agricultural production worldwide, even though they themselves borrowed plenty from the New World. Corn from the Americas, for example. But since about 1450, most of the agricultural systems of what we until recently called the Third World have in fact experienced gradual genetic collapse. We may think it quite natural that immigrant Argentinians, Brazilians, Costa Ricans, Hawaiians, Canadians and Texans raise cattle to export to Europe, the United States, and Japan. But it's only natural in a European sense. It's not natural to those regions, it's not natural to the peoples who are non-European there. Just as to this day, it naturally never occurred to, as far as I know, any European theologian or philosopher to contemplate what third world genetic collapse means for creation and its peoples. We're starting to think about what that loss to the genetic pool of the biological expansion of Europe might mean. Well, it's actually only now as transnational pharmaceutical, petro-agricultural, and biotechnology firms have become interested in these areas that we're now getting the kind of concern for that. Again, I'm not saying Europeans are a different species. They aren't. And they're not genetically any more or less expansionist than other peoples infected with material desire, the glories of heroism, the adventures of conquest, and the heady rush of getting rid of unwanted neighbors. But Europeans were the first to learn and master the great ocean currents and winds, and they were thus the ones that stitched the seams of Pangaea together in such a way as to mean the biological and ecological expansion of Europe. So, Crosby, who's, incidentally, we don't have the book in the bookstore, and my time isn't such that I'm going to share with you a lot from it, but if you enjoy not only important history, environmental history is a relatively new but extremely important discipline, and if you not only enjoy that, but you enjoy just good writing, I commend him to you. Let me just read you one paragraph. The seams of Pangaea were closing, drawn together by the sailmaker's needle. Chickens met kiwis, cattle met kangaroos, Irish met potatoes, Comanches met horses, Incas met smallpox, all for the first time. The countdown to the extinction of the passenger pigeon and the native peoples of the Greater Antilles and of Tasmania had begun. A vast expansion in the numbers of certain other species on this planet began, led off by pigs and cattle, by certain weeds and pathogens, and by the old world peoples who first benefited from contact with land on the other side of the seams of Pangaea. Well, it was indeed drawn together by the sailmaker's needles. In 1492, the sailors first crossed the Atlantic in a way that really stuck. A few years later, 1488, that other marker of Smith, Darwin, Marx, and Engels, the Cape of Good Hope, was rounded as ship after ship headed in the opposite direction. Only 3 decades later, the entire globe was circumnavigated, and by 1600, private citizens and not just sailors were on board. It would only be a matter of time before Broadway would symbolize progress as a cradled ship in the arms of a female figure in the foyer of the New Amsterdam Theater on 42nd Street, with stars and sunbeams as the backdrop. This was what happened then, was a very long geological and biological history was telescoped and climaxed by some few thousands of sailors in a few hundred years. Okay. You know, I'm sure, that what Darwin had already noted in the 1800s, namely the death of Aboriginal peoples in this process, wasn't simply by the wars. Far more of the Aboriginal peoples were killed by the diseases that came with the Europeans. Now, sometimes folks really got nasty. I mean, the U.S. cavalry first infected the blankets with smallpox that they then traded to Indians. But far more, it was often the case that it was an unwitting transmittal of diseases and also of weeds. And feral animals, wild animals. That's the famous problem of rabbits in Australia, or pigs in some other places. And the folks knew this. There's an old story passed on by the Iowa Indians. The Iowa Indians have a mythic hero. And the mythic hero's name is Sanday. And he comes across a stranger in one of the stories of the Iowans. The stranger is dressed in a black suit and wears a tall hat. Now that's the dress of the Christian missionaries to the Iowans, to Iowa, before the Lutherans got to the core. All right? The stranger speaks first in this meeting of the tall man in the black suit and the tall hat with the hero, Sanday. Stranger speaks first. "Who are you?" Reply. "I'm Sanday. I'm the Iowa's old Uncle Sanday. I'm the one who's always coming. Who are you?" "I'm smallpox." I remember the Indians are telling us. "Where do you come from, and what do you do, and why are you here?" "I come from far away, across the eastern ocean." I am one with the white men. They are my people as the Iowans are yours. I am one with the... I travel ahead of them, and sometimes I travel behind. But I am always their companion, and you will find me in their camps and in their houses. What do you do? I bring death. My breath causes children to wither like young plants in the spring snow. I bring destruction. No matter how beautiful a woman is, once she has looked at me, she becomes ugly as death. And to men I bring not death alone, but the destruction of their children and the blighting of their wives. The strongest warriors go down before me. No people who have looked at me will ever be the same. So some folks noticed the biological expansion of Europe and its consequences. All right. In other words, to some peoples, this did not look like salvation and civilization. It looked more like predatory, expansive agriculture and parasitic resource use and the end of their culture, language, and lands. Now, how does that relate to unsustainability, this little bit of history? In Tim Weiskill's words, having expanded upon the things in nature, the West came to believe that expansion was in the nature of things. The very notion that you can have virtually unlimited economic growth is a notion that gets born with the globalization that slid out from Europe. Now, going over these three decisive centuries, perpetual growth was considered natural, good, and inevitable. And that's the notion of progress. So that's at least the connection. So Weiskill goes on to say, what we're trying to do now is to sustain a frontier culture in a post-frontier world. The earth is round, it's curved, it's closed. But the expansion of the neo-Europes and the economic notion of economic development was one which, in essence, assumed a flat earth policy and no end to it, and not a closed sphere. And this expansionist vision lives on even though the earth is no longer flat, or differently said, life, we have grown up with the notion that we could have a life without limits in a world of our own making. That's the conviction that rode along with the sailors and the dual swarmings of population growth and then 50 million immigrants. This is the dream and the drive of modernity, and it began long before Ronald Reagan and the first neoconservative was invented. Actually, at the height of the Great Depression in this century, at the World's Fair in Chicago, people could still claim, as the World's Fair did, a century of progress without batting an eye. I mean, this really took hold as an informing notion. So Promethean power for the transformation of nature and culture together by way of economic messianism is modernity's very soul and pulse. The difference between 1492, 1776, and the present is that that transformation is now fully institutionalized around the globe. And it is self-evidently organized as economic development. This is not going to be easily rooted out, but it is unsustainable. And that's what finally will bring it to major change. The bulk of Adam Smith's library, after all, is not in his native Scotland or even at the University of Texas. It's in Tokyo. This is now a global reality, and that's why we properly speak of a globalizing economy. But it's not global in the sense that everybody on the globe was a part of its development. It slid out from Western Europe. All right. For his part, Crosby uses the delightful image of Sweet Betsy from Bart. Got the hum yet? You still got it? All right. You all who came in a little bit late didn't get in on the practice. We're going to sing Sweet Betsy from Pike as a closing here, or just closing of this part of it, and then opening of the discussion. Crosby uses Sweet Betsy and her entourage because they capture in one image the biological expansion and the ecological imperialism of Europe, together with its cultural expansion and cultural imperialism. Now, Crosby's source, of course, is this favorite frontier folk song, Sweet Betsy from Pike. Betsy herself was from Pike County, Missouri. And she crossed the high mountains, those were the Rockies, with her lover Ike. But it wasn't just Ike she had along. There was two yoke of oxen, a large yellow dog, a tall Shanghai rooster, and one spotted hog. And then Crosby writes, Betsy was heir to a very old tradition of mixed farming. And whereas it must be pointed out that her oxen were castrated and the other animals without mates, Betsy's party was not the only one to cross the mountains. Wagon trains had bulls and cows, plus hens and dogs and pigs of genders opposite to those of her animals. Betsy herself had the foresight to bring Ike. Rapid propagation of the colonizing species would be the rule on the far side of the mountain. This is the 50 million. Betsy came not as an individual immigrant, but as part of a grunting, lowing, neighing, crowing, chirping, snarling, buzzing, self-replicating, world-altering avalanche! Sweet Betsy and her avalanche. Oh, don't you remember Sweet Betsy from Pike? She crossed the high mountains with her lover Ike. With two yoke of oxen, a big yellow dog, a tall Shanghai rooster, and one spotted hog, singing toodle-a-ling, toodle-a-ling, toodle-a-ling. There are more verses, I don't know them. Okay, this is then the outcome of the past five centuries, a world-altering avalanche that slid outward from Europe and has upended culture and nature together. And that's the context, part of the context, that has to be the context for asking how did we get to unsustainability and how do we go from unsustainability to sustainability. It's a deeper issue than that. In fact, there have been three great human revolutions: the agricultural, the industrial, and now, if it is a great human revolution, and it probably is, the informational revolution. All three of them had one thing in common. They all configured nature for the sake of human society. And while they paid attention, and especially in the agricultural revolution, to what nature required for its own regeneration and renewal, for the most part, those three human revolutions reconfigured nature for the sake of human society without asking what the planet, other than ourselves, requires for its own renewal and regeneration. Here you start to see the wisdom of Jubilee as a vision of a sustainable society where the land is to lie fallow every seventh year and then seven times seven. The people, the land, and the animals are to be given sabbatical. Debts are wiped out. Ancestral lands are given back to their owners. And you have some sense that things will go wrong, given the kind of folks we are. So you need to restore it as if the land itself had a life of its own upon which we are utterly and totally dependent. All right, there are two things. I said that was a thesis. Now that we're living in a world that is unsustainable, at least at the levels of consumption to which we are accustomed as a part of the richest 1 billion of the planet. And that is a thesis. It can be argued. So that's part of the discussion. The other part of the discussion is how do we begin to get to Jubilee as a vision of and as practices for a sustainable society from here? How do we get from there to here? And the last thing I'm going to say, since some of you are new, there's a chuckle from those who have been here before. Here is a flyer for a new book called Earth Community, Earth Ethics, which will be coming out in October, which tries to say how you get from unsustainability to sustainability and tries to be specific about that, also in terms of what Christian faith has to offer. So the top two-thirds is a little bit about it, and the bottom third is your convenient order form. So you're welcome to one of those. All right. Go for it, or whatever you want to discuss, both in terms of history of unsustainability, or argue with the thesis, or say how do we get from that to sustainability, or if you think it's presently sustainable, how do we do a better job of it for more of the planet?
What's your book say?
Try it and find out.
Part of the sessions I want to do this week, which are Jubilee and the Sustainable Society, are one answer to that. I want to be sharing things which are from the book. I haven't figured out the box top version, the short reply to the question. Yeah?
I think part of it is that we are living high on the hog, and somehow we need to begin to relinquish that, and there needs to be some motivation to do that. And I don't think guilt works that well for humans.
No.
It's been my experience that doing the right thing doesn't motivate people that much. It motivates some people. I wish that it motivated us more as Christians. But I think we can lift up the value of living simply by living simply well. By doing it well, to have pleasures that are simple and aren't destructive, and to give up those pleasures that are destructive, and to feel like we're doing something important, and to evangelize about that.
Yeah. I was surprised. I didn't even know the existence of the journal that I picked up here called Communities, a journal of, and does it say sustainable communities? I can't remember. That particular issue is on eco communities, but it changes subject from issue to issue. And I was surprised to find out that there was a network of 540 different communities that are trying to find the ways to live sustainably and well. I mean, enjoying. Yeah. Not out of guilt, but this is a better way to live. Yeah. Yes, Shelley.
This is kind of a tangent, but is nature really completely passive to what mankind does to it? Mm-hmm. Are there things in nature's arsenal to, in some way, shape, or form, compensate for all these mega centuries? I mean, you don't rely on them as the answer, or you do, I don't know. But it's a tangent that I don't hear coming up, that this might not be the place either. But.
Yeah. Nature is not passive, and will have the last word. And a lot of the changes we will make will be forced upon us by nature's unwillingness to bend to a notion that doesn't take into account the details of nature. I mean, the present notion of the global economy doesn't care what the difference is between Tucson and Kuala Lumpur and Victoria and New York City and Toledo. Malls are malls, airports are airports, freeways are freeways. But nature does, and you end up exhausting soils or cutting too much green stuff. There will be reactions. You just don't want to have to live with them, you know.
Some of those reactions, though, may force the issue on the change that or creative responses to those change. I'm not saying the objective is to overcome nature. I'm just thinking nature can help us healing her.
Yeah. The last session I want to do a session on the design principles from nature for human communities. There's a whole movement now called ecological design, which takes a cue from how nature organizes communities of life. And there are some very important principles from that for our own life together. Yeah.
A very chilling thought came in a book review in the New York Times. I don't remember the book anymore, but it was looking at, so it ties into the smallpox thing, it was looking at this new ecological niche which hasn't yet been exploited by any hardy organism, which is humanity. All of the energy that is in our bodies, which an organism might be able to get on top of and just manage to wipe us all out because we're so close, we travel so much. There are very few isolated ones. There are very few that are hardy in a way that this... Uh-huh. So the energy that we have absorbed, in fact, is a great new ecosystem for some organism which has yet to discover how to exploit that. And when it does discover how to exploit that, we are going to be extremely vulnerable. Yeah. It's a fascinating and chilling thought, back to what Shelley's talking about, in the way that, you know, Thomas Berry says you just can't win against nature. Ultimately, nature is going to...
Well, there are lots of reasons why you don't win against nature. As I mentioned in one of the sessions last week, everyone sitting in this room and every human being alive is a heterotroph. And no offense. Coming to that, all green plants are autotrophs. Autotrophs are the only creatures that can take inorganic matter and create organic matter of it. All heterotrophs are all utterly dependent upon autotrophs. And as human beings use a larger and larger percentage of green stuff, on the planet or don't have room for an adequate amount. And not just for themselves, but for all other living things, they create serious problems, because you and I don't do photosynthesis well. And chlorophyll will have the last word in all of this. And there's nothing you can do about that. Please.
I'm not sure I buy all of your premises.
Yeah.
The horse, when it was introduced into the North American continent, within 200 years, it transformed numerous Indian agricultural tribes, agricultural societies, into nomads. The Europeans lived with the horse for 6,000 years. I very strongly would doubt that exchange did not have some genetic effect. We've domesticated animals in many cases in less than 6,000 years, and yet when my ancestors, a couple hundred years ago, I'm a German-Russian, when we were invited into Russia to teach agriculture because they still hadn't quite caught on to it, about, I'm told, 30 to 40% of them were murdered off by horse raiding parties, which is why agriculture never caught on there. Europe having to withstand this and having been involved in this for that length of time, I think has to have had some genetic effect, and it's not necessarily a good genetic effect. That the way we drive on freeways perhaps has something to do with this. The way we interact with other peoples, our aggressiveness perhaps has something to do with this.
Mm-hmm. I find it interesting, but I'm not clear about what I said that you're responding to.
You made the statement that we are not genetically different than than others.
Yeah, I see.
And I think that might a reality.
All right. Yeah, I was passing along Crosby's statement that he didn't think Europeans were by nature more aggressive, and thus he said genetically different. But are you saying that as well, that may not be the case?
I'm saying that to me it looks like there would be good evidence that we may be more aggressive.
I'm not sure that I'd call it more aggressive. I see nature as coming to a balance. When you do something in nature, it tends to repair itself to some extent. And I think there's too many people and too many interests, and we're making too much use of your green stuff in supporting our needs. But I don't hear you talking about how to bring the problems in balance, which is population. Population growth is huge, it's humongous, and it isn't stopping. And that's why some of your big problems, your diseases in the past have kept population balanced.
Yeah.
But I don't hear you talking about that. I hear you talking about a small group like the Wilderness Society saying you got to change your ways, you got to protect nature because it's important. And that's true, but you're not going to keep nature the same. Some of those animals that die out because our population pushes into their habitat, they won't. They probably are destined to die out anyway, and there's a lot of them that die out that we don't even know about. And I don't know how you change that. I don't think you can keep nature on the same road and unchangeable.
Well, it's never unchangeable. I mean, there's never been a point where it wasn't changing.
Changed. That's right.
Yeah.
But I don't see how the big problem is the population growth, and it's moving out into that other habitat, and I don't see how it changes it.
There's no question about that population is an exacerbating factor of rate for all other problems, including crowding out of habitat, also for social problems. It's very tricky talking about this when you're talking about the threat to the planet, because if you talk about population in terms of numbers of people only, you don't get an adequate indicator of environmental degradation. It doesn't have a correlation with the numbers. About 70% of environmental degradation takes place at the hands of about 20 to 30% of the people of the planet, and they're the richest 20 to 30%, because it's the levels of consumption. A U.S. citizen will consume 60 times that of an Asian Indian in a U.S. citizen's lifetime. So you kind of have the reverse. You have 70% of the world's population responsible for about 30% of the environmental degradation. The 70% are the 74% of the poorest. So one can't simply talk about population as though that were numbers. One has to talk about the consumption levels of varied population. I mean, I read this article on the letters to the editor on the collapse of fish populations. They're greatly endangered now, and a lot of them have simply collapsed. And the letters to the editor were letters to the editor by a professional, professors in the area, and both of them came to this conclusion: you've got too many people chasing too few fish. That was the bottom line. Well, you start looking at the details, and you find out that it's a relatively small number of fishing fleets that capture the vast majority of the fish, because we now have the technology to harvest fish. Even though their numbers have fallen, we have the nets and the sighting systems that make it possible to capture large amounts of fish for these national fleets. It turns out that the vast majority of the world's fishers are people who do it from a small boat and a canoe and a line. That's not few people, that's the vast majority of people fishing. So is it too many people pursuing too few fish? And where did the fish go? Where do the fish go from the commercial fishing fleets? The folks since 1950 in the rich countries of the world have consumed far more fish. It enters into the diet. The Japanese consume far more fish now than they did 50 years ago. So one has to be, it's very tricky talking about population as an issue. There's no question about the fact that high numbers of people exacerbates all the other problems. And you're absolutely right, we've got unprecedented numbers, and that's going to continue for a while. The population at the beginning of this century was 1.6 billion. Population at the end of this century will be the inverse, 6.1 billion. And it'll go up to 8 to 10 billion within the lifetime of a child born today in the Northern Hemisphere. So I agree with you, but one can't simply say, have a picture of kind of hordes of people as though each one were responsible for the same, having the same impact on the planet. Yep, now it's about time to finish here.
All right. The organization Population Limited did some research, and I don't know what your response would be to this, but the conclusion was that as women became more educated, they had fewer children.
Yeah. As women become more educated and have more opportunities, in the society. The population goes down. Yeah, population rates are in decline all over the world now. But the problem is you start with such high numbers. So if you've got $1 billion in the bank and you're getting 2% on that $1 billion, that's a whole lot of money. If you've got $10 in the bank and you're getting 10% on it, that ain't nothing. See, that's so even in a time of declining population rates everywhere, you're still getting unprecedented numbers. That doesn't change what you said. I mean, that's a key.
Also in the 1970s, there was a tremendous push for Planned Parenthood throughout the world.
Yeah.
And then in the 1980s, it was totally obliterated practically. And yet at the same time, they would not allow abortion. So it was sort of just, it had really made it a very definite difference, Planned Parenthood. And along mm-hmm. with that came the education of women as part of mm-hmm. the plan. And mm-hmm. then seeking more opportunities for women. I know when I was in India, they were making certain things, but they had no market. And yeah. the tremendous difficulty there was getting a market.
Yeah, that's why it's both education mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. opportunity mm-hmm. in the society.
Wouldn't that have the effect as women become more educated and have more opportunities, population might go down, but expectation of consumption would rise?
I mean, this
fewer
is,
children would expect more for yeah, each of them. And
yeah, that's why one always has to do the thing in tandem with one another, population and consumption, and use of resources, because population can go up and use of resources can go down. I mean, there are ways of being eco-efficient about these, but you have to be very careful about not putting all your eggs in the basket of technological solutions, because if you the Chinese have decided now to become an automotive society, and if you have automobiles that now get that would get 80 miles to the gallon instead of 30 miles to the gallon, that's real progress in terms of eco-efficiency. But if you quintuple the number of automobiles, the amount of carbon's going into the atmosphere goes up. So, hey, it's been fun, but we gotta quit and sing Sweet Betsy on your way home.